The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 10 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. We are reading the March 2021 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. The theme this month is the Roanoke River. Last week, as is usual, we worked on the pictorial, and it was quite long this month, and we didn't finish, and because it happens to be discussing a section of North Carolina that I'm somewhat familiar with, if please allow me to finish it for you. It's only three more pages, I think, but I'm going to talk first about the town of Plymouth, which is just at the base of the Albemarle Canal where the Roanoke River flows into it. Hard to believe, perhaps, but Plymouth, this sleepy river port, was in 1864 just about the most important place in the South for President Abraham Lincoln. He wanted Union troops to take the lower Roanoke River choke point back from the Confederates, then move on upstream and cut the Weldon Railroad Bridge and rebel supply line to Virginia. Nowadays, Plymouth is the jumping-off point to a natural heritage wonderland from the Roanoke Bottomland Islands, filled with songbirds that return by the thousands each spring, to nearby national wildlife refuges southeast of town, where phenomenal flocks of geese, swans, and ducks overwinter, and where great sloughs of black bears wander year-round. The caption for the picture says nothing is missing in downtown Plymouth. I might disagree with that, but let's see what they say about it. A maritime museum anchored by a replica of the old Roanoke Lighthouse stands on one end of Water Street, the small and Gothic lovely Grace Episcopal Church at the other. Between the two, the Garden Spot Cafe with its Black Forest pound cake and upstairs oyster bar, where Joe Womble waits with a welcome. And, of course, the reason for saying Joe Womble is here is this smiley gentleman leaning on the bar. I can't quite read his T-shirt because I think it says something, ahoy, I like carbs, or something like that. Ahoy, I cut carbs, I think is what it says. I don't really quite get it. It's like it's a pizza knife underneath. I cut carbs. Well, there you go. And there's a delicious-looking dessert on the panel beside him and a picture of the church and of the lighthouse that they mentioned. We have an aerial view of the town. It has a very big town green where I believe they've hauled an old lighthouse and put it out there for you to visit. It's rather a low-lying lighthouse, but has light at the top of it. And then there's a lot of dock space out here in Plymouth. This was taken at a time of year when there were absolutely no boats. Well, there's one sailboat on not a private dock, but further down. But on the town docks, there's absolutely no boats. But it's a nice, clean-looking downtown. Overleaf Purchase Islands. In his 1624 map, Captain John Smith of Jamestown fame named the Purchase, and Purchase is spelled with a C-E at the end, not an S-E, Purchase Isles of the Lower Roanoke for his friend Samuel Purchase, whose name ironically ends in an S, whose collection of sea stories and adventure travels, Purchase His Pilgrimage, Tales Collected Dockside from Returning Mariners at the English Port of Lee, was one of the most popular books of its day. From Williamston down to Albemarle Sound, these islands are Conneen, Tabor, Great, Huff, Wood, Goodman's, Rice, Louse, and one unnamed. There's a possibility for someone in the future, I guess. On 9,000-acre Bull Run Island, left out of the purchase group, a small, long abandoned logging locomotive still rusts and weathers away at the bottomland's absolute mud. And there's a picture here of a couple of the Purchase Islands. And Edenton Bay, a place that I am familiar with. This is the final picture. One morning on our honeymoon, Anne and I spun our John boat down Spanish mossy Pembroke Creek out into the broad, still Edenton Bay, the shining waters across which historic Edenton looks out upon Albemarle Sound, just east of the mouth of the Chowan River. Unafraid of the old French cannons set at the waterside, we circled the harbor below the Barker House and the Double Piazza homestead several times till we felt we had made it our own. A great blue heron atop a short cypress gazed down upon our going out and our coming back, seeming to bless us with stoic regard. So we took that heron on home with us in our hearts, and we have it yet. When the sun sets over the old Sound and River Lighthouse in Edenton, it falls slowly, too, over the vast swamps at the mouths of the Roanoke and Chowan Rivers, over 90-foot Pleistocene bluffs and all the ospreys of Swan Bay, over the Purchase Islands, over Okeechobee Neck and miles of rocky Falling River between Roanoke Rapids and Weldon, over long lakes that give us both power and pleasure. This is the watery world, one of the great rivers of America, and one of the great blessings of our commonwealth, the Roanoke. This is a picture taken, I think, from a beach location where you can look out and you see these cypress trees that are completely immersed in the water, and not completely, the roots are extending down into the water. They fan out to give it extra support, and we've got a seabird landing, wings spread out and legs extended, ready to just about to hit the water. And in the background, we see those buildings they talked about. They took a lighthouse and they from someplace, and they trucked it there, and they put it out on stilts in the water. Actually, it was on the first time I saw it, it was on land, and then they built up a base for it out over the water, and you can go out and you can visit the lighthouse there. It's a very interesting little town. Very nice late afternoon picture. The sun is setting in a big glow in the lower right of white. The rest of the sky is all yellow, reflecting yellow on the water. Just like I said earlier last week, I said we had a water scene where the pink of the sky reflected in the pink of the water. This is yellow water, at least the part in front of us, and then it turns blue in the background. So that is the end of the pictorial, and we can move on to the lead article under the heading Small Towns, Big Bites Menu. Nothing could be finer than to dine in Carolina. To celebrate our favorite destination dining spots in unexpected towns across the state, we asked one of the South's most renowned chefs to trace North Carolina's fine dining scene to its earliest roots. Written by Bill Smith. In the 1950s, when I was growing up in New Bern, fine dining meant the Governor Tryon Hotel. We didn't go out to restaurants much. Those were the days of multi-generational households where good cooks held sway, making such things seem both unnecessary and financially reckless. "I could have made that whole meal for $3, would have been the refrain. My elders remembered the Depression and never got over it. But special occasions might have been an exception. I remember as a little guy getting all dressed up each year to meet my Aunt Teresa for my birthday lunch at the Governor Tryon. I don't recall what we ate, but I do remember chandeliers, polished wood, and big mirrors reflecting the candles on my cake. This was a time before restaurant chains became established, so our other choices away from home were lunch counters, drive-ins, barbecue joints, and fish camps. Good food, to be sure, but not white tablecloth-worthy. The only time we went out as a group and sat down to eat somewhere was during our yearly beach cottage week along the North Carolina coast. As likely as not, we would be near Morehead City, so people would argue over going to Captain Bill's, the Sanitary, or the Beacon. I think dining habits began to change around the time I moved to Chapel Hill to go to college in 1967. More and more women were entering the workforce, some because their families needed the income, others because they had career aspirations of their own. In any case, there were fewer homemakers. The food industry adapted as demands changed. Good food had to be considered in terms of convenience and economy. Choices grew as the world became busier and perhaps pickier. The time had arrived when people needed nice restaurants where they could host a party or the business dinner, where there would be good food and a decent drink. There had always been restaurants like this in urban areas. Now they were beginning to pop up all over. University towns are among the first of those places. They were more likely to have a portion of their population that had traveled or lived away from home, people who had learned that new things can be fun and interesting, and that you needn't be suspicious of an unfamiliar recipe for coleslaw. Attitudes about value had begun to shift as well. In Europe, people had long seen an elegant dinner party in a chic restaurant as an evening's entertainment as well as supper. It wasn't until I had been a successful chef for years that my own father ceased to view an evening in a fancy restaurant as anything but a pitched battle to avoid being swindled. I landed in the middle of all of this at just the right time. I was living in Chapel Hill, where I was one of the owners of a music club called Cat's Cradle. It was a fabulous club, but we were terrible business people, so I had to get a day job. One of my roommates was the head waitress at a new, sophisticated French restaurant, and she told me that they were looking for someone to peel potatoes. That French restaurant was La Residence, Bill and Morton Neal's place that had just moved into town from its first location out of the country. Working in that restaurant was exhilarating. Bill and Morton knew French food, but not always how to cook it. So we often learned as we went along. This was excellent training, and I date my general seat-of-the-pants kitchen attitude to those days. The rest is sort of history, I guess. I had discovered that the aesthetics of the kitchen suited me, just as I was beginning to grow weary of running a nightclub. After a time, through luck and attrition, I became the head chef at La Residence. The Cradle was eventually sold, happily, because it's still here. I turned 50 in 2019. In the early 80s, Bill and Morton divorced, and he went on to found Crook's Corner. A decade later, Morton sold La Residence, and I followed Bill down the street to Crook's, although by then he had passed away. In 2019, I retired after 25 years as the head chef of Crook's. Running a restaurant without going broke is hard and complicated, and it was especially so back then. Both the kitchens and the public had a lot to learn in those early days. Back in the kitchen, we were guilty of a sort of innocent snootiness. The public comes for dinner, not for instructions on what they ought to like. And yes, customers, 9 shrimp do cost $12. No, people do not always wait tables because they are between real jobs. Yes, everybody needs to be polite. Lots of people don't like the system of tipping. Actually, lots of other people do. But that's how the dining game is played. Don't tell customers that your ethics won't let you bring yourself to cook a fillet well done. Don't tell your server that you want to split the grilled tuna, but you want each half cooked differently. You see what I mean? In a way, at La Residence, we were working at cross purposes. We wanted to introduce the public to traditional French cuisine that would be new and different to many of them. But we also had to be careful not to scare everyone off because they couldn't find anything familiar on the menu. Allowing people to order a steak, say, without all that sauce, got us over the threshold while we were earning the public's trust. Eventually, people did trust us enough to begin exploring things that were new to them. Whenever I think back on this, sweetbreads come to mind. They are a common bistro item in France, but were virtually unknown and euphemistically named here. Eventually, they developed a huge following. We always joked that if you could get people to taste sweetbreads before you explained what they were, meat from the thymus gland or pancreas of a calf or lamb, they would never look back. People began to see new foods as an adventure rather than a source of peril. These days, the public is impatient with you if you're slow to offer new things, and you'd better have more than one kind of hot sauce. Somehow we've navigated all of this, and all of a sudden, at least until the pandemic hit, we found ourselves with an embarrassment of restaurant riches. All over North Carolina, they began to appear. Small, pretty, and snazzy even. You could linger for hours. Perhaps there was nice music playing quietly in the background. There were lovely wines, and the kitchen paid attention to what they were cooking. If you were a regular, they would remember which table you liked. Some restaurants were formal, some more raucous, others were in between. There might have been a pretty garden. Invariably, there was a pride of place shared among the staff, front of house and back. Best of all for me was that, almost unnoticed, a tribe of esteemed colleagues was gathering. And although we are scattered all over North Carolina, we have managed to become good friends. I realized long ago that my community of restaurant people has been one of the best parts of my career. Those late-night parties that always happen when we've gathered from all over the state to cook for the Beaufort Wine and Food Festival or Chow Chow in Asheville are like being back at the summer camp. And after each one, we can't wait for the next time we can all together. Bill Smith was the chef at Crook's Corner until his retirement in 2019. His cookbook, Seasoned in the South, was a New York Times notable and food and wine best of the best book. I have to tell a little story here, although I'm probably not supposed to, talking about La Residence. When we first moved to North Carolina, we went there with friends without a reservation. And because we didn't have a reservation, I had my friend go inside and make sure they had a table for us. And he went inside and he came back out and he said, I'm sorry, he said, they told me they were full and they had no room for us. And I said, well, I really don't know any other restaurants around here. Go back and ask them what the second best restaurant in Chapel Hill is. So he went back in and he asked them and he came back out. They said, come on in. As soon as we asked for the second best, they let us in. And now, where everybody knows your name, the Prescott in Kernersville. A Kernersville chef brings the intimacy and familiarity of a local diner to high-end entrees and even a fancy burger that defy small-town expectations. Written by Debbie Moose. For Trey Prescott, being a high-end chef in a small town means finding a balance between expressing his own vision about food and dining and understanding, but not underestimating his customers. Prescott grew up in Kernersville, which means that many of the folks he serves at his casual yet elegant bistro, the Prescott Restaurant, are neighbors who know his family. In the kitchen, the 37-year-old chef merges his small-town roots with big-city flavors using local ingredients with a continental sensibility. He began developing the style while working at Heron's in the Umstead Hotel and Spa in Cary alongside one of the South's top chefs, Scott Crawford. I model a lot of how I am as a chef and how I worked with Scott, Prescott says. People were coming for an experience, and you have to work your butt off to make sure they had the best experience. Prescott cooked at Heron's from 2011 to 2014, and his work ethic and positive attitude left an impression. I knew that once Trey developed his own style, there would be no stopping him, says Crawford, who now has two restaurants in Raleigh, Crawford & Son and Jolie. It's heartwarming to hear that his time in my kitchen inspired him. It's what it's all about. Small towns like Kernersville can be stereotyped as places where people are only interested in diner food or pizza, but that description is far from accurate, particularly now. Located smack dab between Winston-Salem and Greensboro, Kernersville, whose population is just over 24,000, is growing. Beginning in the early 2000s, local officials invested in the downtown area where the Prescott is located, building a park and adding an ice skating rink behind the Kernersville Museum. Prescott says that the goal was to offer visitors more to see and do than just tour the historic Corners Folly. In 2011, FedEx built a massive distribution hub on the edge of Kernersville, and in 2019, Amazon followed suit. Good businesses are staying here, and we're seeing that money spent in town, Prescott says. Kernersville used to be a bedroom community with a lot of people living here and working in Winston-Salem or Greensboro. Now people aren't leaving as much, and if people live in Winston-Salem and have friends in Greensboro, they come and meet here for dinner. After graduating from Appalachian State University in 2007, Prescott worked at Manor House Restaurant, now Timberlake's, at Chitola Resort in Blowing Rock, Christopher's new global cuisine in Winston-Salem, and Smitty's Grill in Kernersville, co-owned by his dad, Bob. After working at Heron's, the younger Prescott joined J. Pepper's Southern Grill in Kernersville. In 2018, while serving as the executive chef at Jeffrey Adams on 4th in Winston-Salem, Prescott decided that it was time to make a change. I was looking at the name on the front door, and I realized that whenever I had worked 20-hour days in the kitchen, it was always for someone else, Prescott says. Why am I doing this for somebody else's name on the front door? He developed a business plan for an intimate bistro, and his father became a silent partner. They found a location on South Main Street, just up from the Paul J. Senior Botanical Garden. We had to be here a few months to convince the good old boys to come in for a date night, Prescott says. But once they did, they saw it wasn't intimidating, but comfortable. People really embraced us. Prescott finally had a place with his own name on the door, a restaurant where he was able to design everything from the decor to the menu. Since the Prescott opened in December 2018, business has been good. There was hesitation about doing this in Kernersville, he says. At first they said, nah, but then it came in, I kept it in the back of my mind. Bill Cisna and his wife Kathy have been customers from the beginning, and they say that the restaurant has not only drawn people to Kernersville, it's also helped keep residents dining locally. We had good restaurants before, but for farm-to-table, high-end kind of experience, you went somewhere else, Bill says. He and Kathy like shrimp appetizer with walnut horseradish sauce, and a lemon crepe caper grouper, and the overnight pot roast. And they've attended wine dinners here, including one based on the menu from the first trip of the Orient Express. It's a real pleasure to have that kind of restaurant 7 minutes from us, Bill says. It's our cheers to a certain extent. Understanding his customers and listening to them has made a difference. Prescott has brought back a few early menu items that people missed and added some that he'd never considered. For example, he'd resisted having sandwiches because he didn't want people eating with their hands and getting messy. But he's now added a burger with bacon jam in response to one customer in particular, his father. He said, "Where's the burger?" So we got a burger on there, and he loves it. And we get a lot of compliments on it, Prescott says. The community support has helped Prescott as he's adapted to changing needs amid COVID-19 restrictions, whereas before he created dishes to educate diners about ingredients and techniques and to offer new experiences, he now focuses on food for comfort, not stereotypical Southern comfort food, but such things as the simple satisfaction of a good piece of fish or a flavorful roast. The Prescott Restaurant is located at 126 Main Street in Kernersville. Well, I am not sure how much time we are going to have here to finish up, so I think the thing to do would be to go back and read some of the shorter articles at the beginning so we don't have to truncate. I'm going to pick one that I highlighted first because I'm a bourbon drinker. This one's about bourbon. Welcome home, drink up, Bogue, better with age. Following generations of family recipes and guidance, this Carteret County distillery crafts spirits that are rich in history and smooth in flavor. Richard Chapman can picture his stepfather's 10-gallon copper still and smell the peach and apple brandies he helped concoct on their Lee County farm like it was yesterday. That still was not unlike the one that Chapman's ancestors had hauled from Scotland to the U.S. a century earlier. Chapman, owner of Bogue Sound Distillery, hails from a long line of distillers and servicemen. Naturally, he named each of his locally sourced and crafted spirits after his own family's military history. John A.P. Connolly, bourbon, which also comes in peanut butter and salted caramel flavors, my goodness, pays tribute to his great-grandfather, a cavalry officer during the Civil War. Vitzelin Vodka commemorates the Union nurse who saved Connolly from the brink of death after battle. And Bombshell Gin, dry with a hint of cucumber, is a nod to Chapman's father, who served as a B-17 bomber pilot stationed outside of London during World War II. Since opening the coastal distillery in 2018, Chapman has offered tours of the facilities and adjoining museums to teach visitors about the cooking process, pointing out the barreling areas and bottling machines, and show off the antique corn grinder from 1908. The best part, he says, is when everyone heads up to the full bar to sip on the family spirits. Bogue Sound Distillery is at 108 Bogue Commercial Drive in Bogue, North Carolina. They have a website, BogueSoundDistillery.com. How about the Music Man from Black Mountain? Songwriter, producer, record label founder, this veteran of the rock and roll industry has done it all. At a venue near his hometown, he provides a space for performers to express themselves and for the audiences to listen. Written by Katie Kane. When Bob Hinkle first stepped into the old brick building in the heart of downtown Black Mountain, he knew that the space was made for performers. The curved wooden ceiling was high enough that he had to crane his neck to see the arched beams. They were only noticeable from inside the former car dealership. The acoustics were perfect for his next endeavor. 7 months later, the White Horse Black Mountain Performance Venue was open for business. Hinkle, a successful music producer, turned venue host, had a clear vision of a place where people could gather to celebrate a passion that he and so many others share, music. Since its grand opening in 2008, Whitehorse Black Mountain has become a sort of downtown living room for folks to wander in, sit back on a comfy couch, and spend the evening being entertained by hand-selected performers from all over. It's a listening room, Hinkle says. The whole point of this is that you're actually supposed to come in and listen to the music and make contact with whomever is on stage. Hinkle grew up just down the road in West Asheville. There he spent countless hours listening intently to Sweet Corn Serenade, his favorite Western North Carolina radio show. The first song to entrance the young audiophile was the Caught It, or to entrance the young An audiophile was the cowboy classic Ghost Riders in the Sky. It had such a great story and a lot of images in it that were very intriguing for 4 or 5 year old kids sitting in a green rocker in West Asheville back before that area was cool, Hinkle says. He began his career as a musician just a few years later. When he was 10, he performed a Harry Belafonte song at the 5th grade talent show with his treasured restrung silvertone guitar. There were girls in the 5th grade that talked to me after that show who had never talked to me before, he says. He took that as a sign that he was on the right track. The White Horse Black Mountain is at Montreat Road in Black Mountain, North Carolina. WhiteHorseBlackMountain.com, of course. Currently closed due to COVID-19. But tune in to live shows online at WhiteHorseBlackMountain.com. Well, that is about all the time we have for today's episode of Our State Magazine, and I hope you enjoyed it, and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call the studios, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.